My name is Nan Bryan. I am glad you're sticking around, folks, because we will promise you a very lively discussion up here from these three ladies. I would like to take just an opportunity to encourage all of you to think about joining Eastside Progressives. We are unabashed supporters of the wonderful Eastside. We are committed to providing forums like this and also getting out the vote activities. So if any of you would like to become active with our planning committee, please talk to my husband Bob at the table back there, and he'd be happy to write your name down and sign you up for some volunteer activities with Eastside Progressives. We really want to include all people in progressive activities in this part of town, so give it some serious consideration. The candidates that we have here tonight, I've gotten to know pretty well over the last few months. I've been at other forums with them. So we have Ali Muldrow, who is running for seat 6. And she is a lifelong Madison resident, a graduate of East High School. So she's very comfortable in this part of town. And she's the director of youth programming at GSAFE. Seated next to her is Kate Taves. Kate is a former educator and businesswoman and the mother to 3 children in the district. And at the end we have Nikki Vandermeulen, who is a juvenile defense attorney. And I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge Ed Hughes and the work he has done with the district. Ed has withdrawn from this race for the Board of Education, but it's very important for all of us to realize that while Ed has withdrawn, his name remains on the ballot. And should he have the most votes, he will then have to, well, he could accept and he could stay on the board, actually, or he would have to resign. And then that seat would be tossed back to the Board of Education for a decision about how that seat would be filled. So keep that in mind as you go to the ballot, remembering that Ed has said that he has withdrawn, and keep in mind the service that he has provided to the district and wishing him and his wife well in the future. We have drawn lotteries, as we have done before, in setting up this forum, and the protocol will be the same as the previous candidates. We will have a 3-minute opening. Nikki Vandermeulen was the winner of the lottery, and so she will open with a 3-minute opening statement. We are not going to have these candidates come to the podium. They are going to stand at their seats and pass the microphone back and forth. So Nikki, you're on.
Hi, my name is Nikki Vandermeulen. I am running for seat 7 for the Madison School Board. I'd like to thank the Eastside Progressives for hosting this event, and I'm really honored to be here tonight. I'm running for school board to give a voice to the voiceless. Very simply, everyone deserves a quality public education, but not everyone is getting one. And I know what it's like to be treated differently. If elected to the school board, I will be the first autistic individual openly identified on the Madison School Board. I take that job very seriously. We need to advocate for all students, whether they be special ed, regular education, or just need a little help. And one way we can do this and make our schools better is to limit the use of suspension and expulsions in our public schools. Very simply, out of the number of students expelled, that's out of the expulsion pool, 61% are African American males and 35% are the disabled. Yet they make up 18%, 14% of our population. That's clearly way too many, and we need to change that. One way we could do that is by improving the behavior education plan. I suggest with community input to create a rubric of sorts which compares behavior A to behavior B to make sure if student A breaks a window, student B breaks a window, the punishment is the same if the circumstances are the same, because it takes some subjectivity out of the issue. Another issue that I would do to make our board at our school better would be to ask the hard questions on open enrollment. Why are we losing over 1,000 students a year to open enrollment? Why don't we do a simple exit strategy to ask why they're leaving? You can't improve a school if you don't know what you're doing well and what you're doing poorly. And thirdly, what's also very important to me is job readiness. We are sending students out into this world who are not prepared with the work skills that they need. This could be accomplished two ways. One, increase the tech and vocational classes at our schools. Currently, we have the assumption all kids go to college, and I'm not against this assumption. But did we ask if everyone wants to go to college? If someone wants to go to a vocational school or a tech school, why don't we provide that opportunity? Why are we deciding for them? Additionally, I believe the other thing for job readiness that we have to do is to provide hands-on learning and real-life skills. Thank you very much, and I ask for your support on April 4th.
Hi folks, my name is Kate Taves. Thank you for having all of us tonight. I am running for school board because I'm a deep believer in public education. I have three young kids. My oldest is a first grader in the district, and I'm terrified right now that their schools are going to be defunded from state and federal attacks. I'm also pretty hopeful though about our district, because I know here in Madison that we can fight back against intolerance and inequity by providing a fantastic public education for all kids. We ask our school board to provide the leadership to make that happen. It's just seven people, and they meet every week to go through reams of spreadsheets and PDFs and data to try to make the best choices that they can for our 25,000 students. My background, I worked in public schools after college. I taught leadership development and conflict resolution. I ran a peer mediation program. And then I spent the last decade in the business world. For the last year, I was the CEO of a startup that made nutritious meals for senior citizens. I worked quite closely with Meals on Wheels at the time. I've made the kind of financial and leadership and strategic choices that we ask our school board to make day after day for years. And my vision for our district is simple. I believe that we can be the best district in the country, the best public education in the country. I have three priorities. The first is to fight back against privatization at the state level, at the federal level, and more. The second is to make sure that our kids always have the best educators. They spend more time with their teachers than with us some days, and the quality of their teachers, I believe, matters more, and the quality of those relationships matters more than anything else. Third is to address the racial achievement gap that has plagued our district for years with real and sustainable changes. That includes the diversity of our workforce and a greater focus in early childhood education. I'm looking forward to sharing more of my thoughts with you tonight, and thank you again for having us.
Just gonna try to navigate the cord really quick. Good evening, everyone. I'm Aline Muldrow. I'm running for school board, seat 6 for the Love of Learning. Before I had children, before Donald Trump was president, before Scott Walker was our governor, I went to school here in Madison. I know from experience what the achievement gap means. I absorbed the reality of racial injustice in our community, and I became very committed to address those issues. The moment I turned 18, I launched my first class at East High School, a spoken word course, which allowed young people to get academic credit for learning from communities of color and urban expression. I have been a janitor, I have been a security guard, I have been an assistant teacher and artist in residence. I am now, for the last 4 years, the director of youth programming and inclusion at the Gay Straight Alliance for Safe Schools, GSAFE. My entire adult life has been spent advocating for education that is equitable and allows young people access to the best parts of themselves. I believe our schools can be places where young people fall in love with learning, where they feel proud of who they are at school, where their communities are valued and uplifted, where they can be seen for their brilliance and supported when they're struggling. I think that you need diverse representation in positions of leadership. I think you need folks who have firsthand experience with problems that have defined who we are as a community. I think it's really important that our young people be able to look to the leaders in our community and see themselves. I am really, really excited to be here and really honored to have this opportunity. And I can't be up here tonight without thinking about all of the people who didn't get this opportunity, all of the people who didn't have the chance to see themselves recognized in a position of leadership. I have been fighting for the rights of young people within education my entire adult life. I was at the Capitol last year when the bathroom bill came up. I will be there again when it comes up this year. I was at the school board meetings talking about how to make sure Isthmus Montessori is accessible and inclusive and provides services with integrity to students with ranges of abilities. I was at school board meetings when we were talking about the role of the police in our schools. I have been active and passionate about education my entire adult life. I have invested in the leadership of this community and in our schools, and I'm asking our community to invest in my leadership and to become passionate about education. We're in an all hands on deck moment, and I am really excited to work with our community to make sure public education is doing great things and is well resourced. Thank you all.
Thank you very much for the opening statements and our first question, and then it'll go to you, Nikki. MMSD is working to increase the academic achievement of all students. Which specific strategies are working to that end, and what new strategies would you suggest?
One strategy that, it's an excellent question, and one strategy.
Probably it's a good idea. If you can, Nikki, just answer that. Thank you.
Sorry about that. Let me start over, please. One strategy that I found very impressive in this, in the reducing the achievement gap, is the increase in AVITOPS funding, especially with peer mentoring. I think peer mentoring is incredibly important. One, we need to work with our students so that, to get rid of this gap, and students who've gone through it or who are older and have lived in that same environment, it has a much greater effect. Additionally, a second thing that we are doing very well in our schools is the community school idea. Having the community, having certain schools open all the time as a community center is a great idea. We have people who are active all the time. You get to work with a wide range of businesses and wide range of people. And I think that's very helpful. But what we need to do to truly get rid of the, and we got to get rid of the achievement gap. To do so, we have to get rid of the number of suspensions and expulsions. A kid cannot learn if they are not in school. The reason I got involved in this race is I kept seeing the same juveniles over and over and over again, and saw that they were being put in for little things like disorderly conduct, things that could be handled by detention, or even better, restorative justice, which I've been extremely proud of our restorative justice program in our schools. But very simply, we keep putting more kids into the criminal system, punishing truancy by putting a child into the juvenile detention center. What we need to do is to focus on in-house behavior discipline, and instead of focusing on suspensions and expulsions, we must focus on how to keep the child learning, and that's the best way to fix the achievement gap. Thank you.
So I think there's a couple of things that we've been doing well with respect to how to address the racial achievement gap. The first is, and I'm a big believer in early childhood education, and we have over the last several years really dedicated a focus to lowering class sizes and literacy at the K through 2 level. I would actually even increase that focus and move even earlier than K to 4K, and to work with the city better on even before 4K. We know that kids are coming into school already with a 3 or 4 year gap in literacy levels, and that's simply something that we can and should be addressing earlier. It's something that we've started to do, and I think we need to keep moving in that direction. In terms of what we could be doing better, there's a couple of strategies that are proven strategies that I believe really we would benefit from here. One is the diversity of our staff. We have 57% students of color in our district, but the diversity of our staff is nowhere near that.
And it's simply something we need to do better at. We actually have done quite a good job at the administration level. 22% of our administrative building, the Doyle Building, is staff of color. But in our schools, only 3% of our staff are African-American teachers. Right, so there's a dramatic gap. We know we can do it. We've proven we can do it at the administrative level. We need to do better at the educator level. The second thing is class sizes. I think we have done a good job of keeping class sizes small in some cases, not in others. That needs to be more consistent across the district. We know that small class sizes enable development of a deeper relationship with educators and really providing the support that all students need. The third is, so the school that I worked at in Boston had on-site mental health and actually physical health, had doctors. And I think this is an area that our district has really an opportunity to grow in, to integrate mental health services and more holistic care services on-site. I think this is an area that would actually bring families together more and would really resonate with our students.
The reality is we have one of the largest achievement gaps in the country. And so we have been having that conversation for a long time, and we have been taking small, measured steps towards reconciling something that is completely inappropriate. We have spent the last few years doing things that I really admire. I think our school board and our district have really looked at the impact of exclusionary practices around discipline. I think replacing the student code of conduct with the behavior education plan was a move in the right direction. However, I think that we have to have a really holistic approach to the achievement gap. I think we're talking about something that has defined who we are as a community and who we are as a nation. And in order to not have less of an achievement gap, but to actually eliminate the achievement gap, we really need to be thinking big. We need to be thinking about, you know, what is the access young people have to curriculums that allow them to explore their own identities and see themselves as important in the classroom? How do we make sure that we have inclusionary practices? So how are we making sure that young people have the ability to navigate opportunities that are meaningful to them? For everything in our community in which students of color, low-income students, LGBTQ students, students with disabilities are overrepresented, there's an area in which affluent students are overrepresented. Those areas look like advanced learners courses, study abroad programming, theater opportunities. I was really lucky. I went to school here and I had an incredible theater director, Tara Affalter, who allowed me to act in Raisin in the Sun and Fences. She did two plays. She did plays that were about LGBTQ folks. She did plays in Spanish. And I thought that that was just part of our school. But when she left, those opportunities left with her. So how are we making sure that we are having expanded access to opportunities, and how are we sustaining great creative and quality work that is being brought into our district by really passionate professionals? I think that is the area that we have to explore. I'm really interested in how our district moves forward with a commitment to making sure young people have a range of opportunities and the ability to be successful at school.
Sorry. Thank you. You probably all remember a year ago, Eastside Progressives had a forum on racial disparities, and during that forum, we recognized La Follette High School for the outstanding job they were doing in increasing graduation rates for students of color, and they followed that up with a graduation rate of 80% for their African American students last spring. I would like to ask you what you think La Follette is doing right, and what questions would you ask if that graduation rate accelerated, or if it would decline significantly? What questions would you ask? And Kate, you're up first.
All right, so I was just speaking with someone who works at La Follette. I'm gonna go back to people. So I've been the CEO of a company, and I've worked in organizations, and for me, success has always come back to people that are working together in a way that they want to show up for work, They want to accomplish something amazing, and they are dedicated. And so when I think about, you know, what La Follette is doing, right, and it is the only high school, in fact, where our African-American graduation rate is higher than our Latino and other underrepresented groups, I come back to people and a team that's working together effectively, a team that's committed to students and feels supported in the schools. There's a lot of research that shows principals and teams are really, really the thing that makes schools work. And I know at my son's school, the teachers in that school would jump in front of a bus for their principal, right? It's really magical to hear them talk about how dedicated and committed they feel to going above and beyond because they feel supported, they feel heard. And that translates to our kids. My kid gets a hug in and out of that school every time he goes to the bathroom, et cetera, right? And that's because those the staff feel like they want to show, and he goes to the bathroom a lot. So, you know, for me, that comes back to how do we make sure that the culture in our district is healthy and that the culture in every one of our buildings is healthy, that our turnover rate for our staff is not too high. 42% of our staff right now leave within the first 5 years in the district. That is incredibly high, and it's not acceptable. That churn creates a real hardship for our students, for our families, and for school culture. So for me, it comes down to making sure that each building has a fantastic culture, and that translates into kids wanting to show up to school every day too.
Over here, Kate.
Oh, sorry.
You're going to have to do that to you.
Yeah.
And the last forum that Nan moderated, I could never figure out our order, so just...
The question was, La Follette High School has an 80% graduation rate for African Americans. What do I think they're doing well?
Right.
And then what questions would I ask if that changed?
Correct.
La Follette High School is the only high school that has block periods. It's the only high school that teaches in 90-minute chunks. And that allows students to have a greater relationship with experiential learning. It also means there's less homework, and that gives young folks who maybe outside of the classroom don't have access to the support they need or the stability that they need to be successful doing homework, really get to have an intensive relationship with their educators, really get to know their teachers. I also think La Follette has been very lucky to work with some of the most skilled EROs in the district, folks who are really passionate about making sure that young people are supported and not punished when they're struggling. La Follette was the first high school to have restorative justice, and it has very, very successful restorative justice circles, and works really, really well in partnership with the Y. So I think La Follette is doing a lot and has been doing a lot and continues to do more. And I think that's really exciting to make sure that young people are being supported, that they have kind of the structure within their school to access their genius and explore themselves, and that they have real time in the classroom to learn. You know, so I think La Follette is very particular and is doing really interesting things. I think if I saw that was changing or shifting, I think the questions would be really expansive. You know, it's why and how and who are the key players that are navigating that change. I think that we are impacted. There's a ripple effect in terms of how we relate to the world around us, and we have to be aware of that as educators, as people working with children. And so I think there would be a lot of questions.
Quick shameless plug, La Follette will always be a school that's probably really close to my heart. My grandfather was the first principal of La Follette High School, and I appreciate that his legacy is continuing because he was very big in restorative practices. He didn't want kids at special schools. He didn't want kids segregated. He wanted them to learn, and that was his focus, as it is mine. Additionally, an 80% graduation rate is wonderful. I think it, first and foremost, the restorative justice, not to copy Allie, but restorative justice program is absolutely tremendous at La Follette. These circles focus on the issue. They focus on how to resolve it. They don't just tell the students. They teach them strategies and how to use them in different situations. And I think that's incredibly commendable. Two, we have staff that gets along. They like each other. That's wonderful and it's incredibly important. But also, they are committed to our kids because they have the resources, they have the time, they have the ability to say, this is working for me or isn't. And they have a principal who's willing to listen. Not every district is that blessed, not every school is that blessed. We need to listen to our teachers to see what they need. And if that rate were to go down, I would like to ask, why is it going down? What are we focusing on? Are we still treating our teachers with the amount of respect? Are we still giving them input? Are our students still being able to learn? Are they having harder times at home due to the economy? How can we provide and make sure that they have what they need at school? Can we increase the lunch program? Can we increase free breakfast if hunger is an issue? Those are all important issues that need to be addressed. But right now, that's 80% is commendable, and it's because the teachers care, the students care, and the learning community, especially restorative justice, creates an excellent and ideal learning environment.
Thank you. In a recent news report, the Delavan-Darien School District, which is slightly south and a little bit east of here, quote, sent a warning about what to do if immigrant agents come to the door of a student's home, unquote. What should the Madison Metropolitan School District do to support immigrant families and their students? And Nikki, you're first on this one.
I'm originally from Whitewater, Wisconsin. I've been to Delavan many times, and it happens to be one of the larger Hispanic areas in the state of Wisconsin. What we need to do for immigrant students is very simply. One, we need to create a welcoming community. Two, we need to make sure our school officers aren't being turned into ICE officers, meaning Immigration Customs Enforcement Agents, because a school is not a place to detain students. It is a place for learning, and children should not be afraid to have their parents come to an event for fear that they'll get detained, arrested, or even deported. That's unacceptable. And third, we need civics classes, one, to teach students to begin with on the election process and schools in general, but two, that they have rights. As was stated back in Tickert versus Des Moines in 1965, students don't give up their rights at the schoolhouse door. And I think for too long we've stated, oh, you're a kid, you don't have rights. That's not the case. In this case, not informing people of their rights could end up with families being broken up. So we need to be proactive and inform our officers on how to handle the situation. We need to inform our teachers, but most importantly, we must inform our students of their rights.
Now it goes down.
I'm going to say,
Lee is getting it. She knows.
I feel like I found my flow.
I was
going
to say, you know, we've made the pattern evident.
13 forums in, got it down. I think it's really important when you're working with a community that you're not a part of, that you listen to the leadership of that community. I have no idea what it's like to be undocumented. I have no idea what it's like to have my parents be undocumented while I'm a citizen. I think it's really, really relevant that we're reaching out to communities that are directly impacted and asking them what they need for support. I don't think you can compare this community to another community and enact mechanisms of support that have worked for other people. I think you really have to be specific to this moment and the community that is at need. I think that we're a community that really, really values educating every single child. I don't think we have any interest in qualifying who has the right to an education. I think every single child deserves to learn and to be safe and supported at school. But I think for me, when I'm talking about a community that I am not personally a part of, I want to be engaging in a full and robust conversation with that community in order to make decisions that are well informed and respectful of the leadership of the community that I'm working with.
So let me share two specific things for our undocumented community and then talk a little bit more broadly about our immigrant community here. for our undocumented students and families. I think right now is a moment in our country where we need to make a very clear statement, as our city just did, in support of being a safe harbor, being whatever language you want to use. But I would be very supportive of setting a very clear statement from the district that we will not allow ICE into our schools, that we will not share information, that we will be a sanctuary school for our undocumented students and families. I think that's our obligation to make people feel safe to come to school. And I think that this moment in time requires us to have a very loud voice about our values and our beliefs in the schools. Second, I think that we have an opportunity. We have a very talented workforce here in Madison. We have an opportunity to provide legal services to the degree that they're needed and wanted for families. And I think, again, you know, that's something that we could very easily facilitate via the school district should we just decide to. So that's sort of the undocumented, I think, moment we're in right now. And then separately for our immigrant communities, I think this is one of the most vibrant parts of our city. And it is something that we are working to incorporate better into our schools, right? So I am a supporter of our dual language programs. I think it is fantastic that our schools offer the ability for students to learn in their the language that they're speaking at home, that to have culturally relevant curricula and teachers, and have teachers that can communicate and staff more broadly that can communicate with parents. I think that's critical for not only student, but also for family engagement. Yeah, maybe I'll stop there, but so.
Thank you, and Aaliyah is up first on this one. How do you think the district should interact with the legislature? Should MMSD have a lobbyist? And should there be a Board of Education legislative committee that analyzes and responds to legislative proposals and budgets?
In 2 minutes or less.
In 2 minutes or less. Well, the answer is yes. Yes, I think we have an obligation to relate to the larger bodies of governance, and really a unique opportunity to stand up and say we're representing people who don't get to represent themselves. We represent children, you know, and what is in the best interest of children is a very beautiful position to be in terms of how we navigate creating our society. So I think we have the ability to be highly influential. I think we have the ability to be forward thinking, and I think we need to be present and available to make change. I think we as a community have a rich history of standing up for ourselves, of making very clear statements about who we are and what we believe and what we are willing to fight for and sleep in the Capitol for and march in like 2 degree weather for. You know, we are a community that is willing to go the extra mile to do what needs to be done within every arena possible. And so yes, absolutely, I think that we should.
So if you go to the district website and you look at the job for being a school board member, I think there's 7 bullets. There are things like, you know, we approve the budget, we spend almost $450 million in our schools, it's more than half our property taxes, that's a major part of the job. Supervising the superintendent, major part of the job. One of the bullets listed is advocacy and lobbying. It's part of the school board's role to provide leadership for our district at the political level on what we want for our schools. And we control a lot of that right here in Madison with our school board, but not all of it. We are, of course, subject to the state and, unfortunately, the federal government as well. And so, from my perspective, we have an opportunity right now in our state to be proactive. So I started by this evening sharing that one of the things that brought me into this is being worried about privatization. At the state level, at the national level, what was going to happen when our state and federal government were aligned in support of privatization. And I believe that our state, red communities, blue communities, every community, there are many communities in our state that have had education referendums over the last several years. Our communities are telling everybody, the state, whoever is willing to listen, that we want to invest in education. We want to invest in our kids' future. And I think we have an opportunity in Madison to provide leadership on that. I think it'll be a louder voice if we develop a coalition. And I don't think we necessarily need a lobbyist to do that. I think that can be something that we as individuals develop a strategy to do and actually go and build those relationships with districts throughout the state to provide an amplified voice at the state level that says, we want to invest in our public schools. We believe that we need to fund them in order to do that. And this is not coming from Blue Madison. This is coming from the state of Wisconsin.
I've heard a lot about advocacy and lobbying. And as an advocate, may I just say one thing? Advocacy is not a swear word. It's not a bad word, although you sure hear that it's all of the negative connotations. Same thing with lobbyists. You hear they're crooked. You hear they're corrupt. What about lobbyists for good? What about advocates for good? They're out there, and we need to create that relationship. We have a duty to get the best for our students. I'm not against a lobbyist who would train others. I want a trained workforce and trained individuals to work with all teachers so that they can feel and play a role. Very simply, we have a duty to represent our students in every way possible. Yes, we need to advocate with the legislature. Right now, we're offered $630 million, yet we have to punish our teachers in order to get that money. And I don't think that's fair. I don't think that a positive working relationship would necessarily cause that. We need to openly work as a unit. We can't just go, oh, we're Madison schools, we're Milwaukee schools. We have to come together as a state, like Kate said, to say this is what we are all arguing for, our children, and that's what matters.
Okay, these candidates have done this drill before, so I'm going to ask them all to stand up and they're going to have yes or no answers, and I'm going to commandeer the mic and they're just going to let you know if it's a yes or no answer to the question. So the first question is, do you support continuing the Common Core? And we'll just go straight down.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Next question is a question that we asked the candidates for State Superintendent of Public Instruction, and we'll ask it again tonight. Do you support using public taxpayer money to fund private schools? And Nikki, we'll start with you.
Absolutely not.
Nope.
No.
Do you support having citizen members on the Board of Education committees?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, here's a question very specific to Eastside Progressives. On April 23rd, Eastside Progressives will host a forum on the potential impacts of Governor Walker's proposed budget. Senator Janice Ringhan will present a rural perspective. Dane County Executive Joe Parisi will discuss the impact on Dane County. And Superintendent Jen Cheatham will do the same for the Madison Metropolitan School District. Should Eastside Progressives invite Board of Education members?
Yes.
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 Should they attend community forums such as this?
Yes.
Yes.
Will you attend?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
That was a nice evening.
You may have won. That's it, ladies. Thank you. Nikki, you're the first to go on this question. The governor's budget mandates that school district employees contribute 12% of the cost of their health insurance. If the budget passes, what ideas do you have to implement this provision, keeping in mind two facts? First, many staff, including teachers, currently contribute about 3% of the cost. Secondly, beginning in the 2011-12 school year, Madison Metropolitan District staff gave up more than $16 million in take-home pay, and the following year gave up access to a healthcare provider, which saved the district another $5 million a year. So how would you address this issue if the budget passes?
One, I'm just going to openly state that the budget on that particular issue is patently unfair because it pits our teachers against our students. However, as I said, I'm not in the legislature. However, what I would do is very simply, one, I would not limit the insurance three options and force everyone into one option. Not everyone fits into one box. And very simply, we lost $16 million in take-home pay. We've already lost one insurance option to force everyone into one option. How much are we asking our teachers to give up? Already it's a position that is not well respected and it's not being treated well. I just don't think that's acceptable. Secondly, if we are going to do this 12%, we need to divide it equally. If a custodian is normally paying 1.3% for their insurance, we can't just ask them to pay 12% immediately and then say, oh, it won't affect take-home pay. I think we need to have administrators pay more of the cost. I think teachers and janitors need to pay less, and that's what I would do in this particular situation.
I'm next, right?
You are.
I'm not as quick in the pattern. So this is an incredibly vindictive bill. It is not passed yet. It's important to know. If it does pass, there's a couple of things. So first of all, just so that folks know some of the numbers, I'm a numbers person. The budget would take about $5 million basically back from teachers that currently is being given via benefits. And it would also give us about $5 million from the state. So in terms of my approach to this, first, we need to be able to give some of that money back to teachers in pay. It's just a total non-starter. I am endorsed by the teachers union. I also believe that pay matters. I believe that the quality of our teachers is incredibly important, the most important thing for us. And I've, throughout this campaign, talked a lot about the fact that, in particular, our starting pay in Madison is not competitive with most surrounding districts. The proposal that the district has put together right now to address this would bring up our starting pay to something more competitive with Sun Prairie, Middleton. Doesn't quite get us to where Milwaukee is, but it's closer. And I believe that's the right direction, that we can and should give back some of that quote-unquote savings via pay so that it's not as challenging for our teachers to absorb a significant increase in costs, which is a significant decrease in pay. So first that, the second is a living wage. And again, this is actually part of the proposal that the district has right now, is to convert some of that savings into a living wage for our special education assistants. These are called SEAs. They are the paraprofessionals that work with our neediest students. They currently take home about $14,000 a year total. And it's because they are paid not a living wage and they don't have full-time work. It's these are people that we need to have long-term relationships with our kids. Having them churn in and out because they're not making a living wage is unacceptable. So that's the second area that I would refund with some of that money.
I think resources are really important, and the integrity of the relationships we have with the people we're working with is vital to the success of our schools and the success of our students. We lose about $6 million through open enrollment out of the district, so I think we have to think really strategically right now about what it means to attract students to our district. There's only two ways to generate revenue for our district. It's through referendums and through students attending our schools right now in this current political climate. I think what Nikki is describing is kind of what we do right now. Right now, if you are a food service member of our faculty, you pay the least amount for your health insurance. You pay about 1.5%. If you're a teacher, you pay about 3%. If you are an administrator, you pay about 10%. My mother and my sister both work for the state. My mother's worked for the state for about 20 years. Her health insurance has gone up every single year. I feel that. It's totally real at the end of the night. But you know, like, we have to be really savvy. We have to be really agile in how we navigate resources in this current moment. We also can't be a district that compromises who we are and the integrity of our relationships with a price tag associated to it. So I think our reaction needs to be one that is mobilizing our entire community to really care about the reality and the strain that we're putting on our educators. I think we need to raise awareness around the unfairness of asking our educators to go from paying 3% for health insurance to paying 12%. But also we really have to look at what does that mean to somebody who's paying 1.5% right now. I think we talk about how teachers are impacted oftentimes, and we forget how folks like janitors and food service folks are impacted by these things, but those are devastating. That is a devastating impact to that family, and I think that we have to be aware of it and willing to speak to it.
Thank you. Issue that's probably more important in this part of the district than maybe in the other high school attendance area. Currently, when the city of Madison annexes property to the district, that property may and probably will remain in the school district where that property originated. Right now, the city is annexing property from Burke, the town of Burke. Most of that is in the Sun Prairie School District. It would benefit the district greatly if that property could be attached to the school district. Is this an issue you have thought about, know about, and do you have any ideas what strategies the district should pursue to bring this property into the school district when it comes into the city?
I have to be completely transparent. This is not an issue that I feel like I am super familiar with. I think that the way we invest and navigate resources has to be really well informed. And so I hesitate to speak to something that I haven't researched thoroughly. And I want to be honest about that with you all. I think it's really important that we have, you know, the ability to be transparent about what we don't know and what we haven't experienced. And so I would say I would have to learn a lot more in order to speak to it accurately.
Thank you.
So this is a topic that we've, in slightly different terms, had a history of in our Fitchburg attendance area. So we, MMSD includes about a third of Fitchburg. The other parts of Fitchburg zone to other cities, and actually Fitchburg itself has no schools of their own. And over the years, Fitchburg has tried to build schools of their own, and they have not successfully been able to take the property because of the value of the property taxes that come along with it out of those school districts' hands. To be honest, maybe I'll give a different honest answer, which is, doesn't seem like a fight that's worth the amount of time and energy that might take. I think in today's civic funding environment, the ability to gather taxes is not something that cities are very willing to give up. And Sun Prairie has clearly demonstrated a willingness and ability to invest in their schools. Their population is growing. Their young population is growing due to housing costs. Which is bigger than the school district in terms of just being able to change it. That may not be the right answer, but it is an honest answer. I'm a big believer in prioritizing time and effort into kind of fights that are achievable and the right thing. And I think our district has a lot of those right now that are worthy of our time and effort. And I'm not sure this one would have an outcome that is what we might want.
I'm going to quote Allie's earlier answer because it happens to apply. There are two ways we can make money in this district. One, referendum. Two, increasing the number of students in our school. Very simply, if we annex the property, they should come here because that means more money, more students, less possibility of closure of schools. Therefore, on that narrow point, I would say absolutely. However, we have to choose our battles carefully. Can we afford to right now handle what will definitely be a possible civil lawsuit? And is that cost averse to the district? And that I would like to research more before fully answering. But I do believe annexation, if we take the property and make it part of Dane County, I strongly believe that the students should stay in MMSD. Thank you.
Thank you. I will talk to all of you afterwards.
That would be wise.
That would be wise.
That would be wise.
The current Board of Education structure consists of two committees of the whole, the Operations Committee and the Instruction Committee. Each of these committees meets once a month or monthly. There also is a regular Board of Education meeting each month. Would you suggest any changes to this structure? And if so, what and why?
The main change I would suggest is very simply, I want more public involvement. And right now we're providing materials on a Thursday night for a Monday meeting. You wouldn't expect an attorney to be able to defend a case in front of the Supreme Court with 4 days' notice. How are we expecting our citizens to be well informed on the issues when they don't have access to the material? Additionally, the other thing I would change is not the meetings, is when we have the meetings, not everyone can make it. So one, make sure that they are online or have so people can follow along. But additionally, why can't we have a meeting once a month in the community every now and then? So that way those who can't get to meeting at 5 p.m. on a Monday night because they work or their kid has soccer or ballet, they still have a way to be involved. So those are things that would change. Additionally, I want more transparency. I think our district has done a good job on keeping citizens abreast of issues, but I want this information from all the meetings to be fully accessible to the citizens and at a much quicker rate. Thank you.
So briefly, I don't have any suggestions on changes from the governance structure. I would on two things, time and location. So the location of our meetings right now is in the Doyle Building. I think it would be fantastic if we rotated through the schools. I am in our schools regularly, and it is incredibly valuable to me to see and feel what they look like during the day as well. So and this is something pretty achievable. It's not like school board members only work on school board at night. It's a bigger job than just the 3-hour meeting. And so I think it would be very achievable for us to rotate meetings through our schools and to actually change the time so that they could be during the day where kids are actually in the building. It's kind of a healthy thing for school board members to be interacting with students. And that would also give our families different opportunities, yes, depending on work schedules, to attend the meetings.
I think in talking about the structure of the school board, we have to acknowledge kind of the power dynamic. Do we have any folks in here who are fans of the film A Wonderful Life? Anybody remember that? So in the film, A Wonderful Life, when you sit in Potter's office, the legs are cut off your chair so that you're shorter than him. I know this is like an interesting thing to point out, but it's a dynamic that is emphasized at school board meetings, that you're actually, they're on stage, and when you come to speak to them, they're way above you. I think we have to reconcile the power dynamics of the school board. I think we have to be available to the community. And I think that is about structure. I think that's about, you know, when you have the meetings and where you have the meetings and who has access to those meetings. I think that we have the capacity to interact with I'm a millennial. We have the capacity to interact with multimedia in a way that is highly effective, that really allows us to have town halls so that if you're sick or if you're exhausted or if you're working overnight and you have a question that you want somebody to give a live answer to rather than an email, that we are embracing a relationship with technology that makes that possible. I think the structure of the way the board is connected to our community is really relevant and is something that we need to examine carefully and get a lot of input from the community in order to make sure that we are effectively allowing folks access to sharing their perspective and informing our board of the realities that their students are facing.
Getting onto the mic. We are now at the point of the closing statements, so Ali will go first and we'll go right down the line.
2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Thank you all so much for being here tonight, for taking time on your Sunday to be with us and to listen to us. I will say that my worst fear for our school district is that we get better, is that we aim to get a little better and that 10 years from now, we're not the worst in the nation, we're one of the worst, or we're not, you know, that we go from being 50 to being 35 and we're really proud of it. I think we have this incredible and tremendous opportunity to do what's never been done before, to shoot, to aim for the forefront of inclusion, to aim for an excellent education for every student, to be bold and determined, to inspire our community to care deeply about our schools and be connected to our schools in a way that is significant and powerful and informs our greater community. I am really excited to work incredibly hard to make sure we achieve a school district in which every single student has access to the best parts of themselves, a school district in which young people know that they are safe and celebrated, in which we cultivate people who are intelligent and caring and value one another's communities. I think we have the ability in this moment, in this now that has never happened before, to do tremendous things, and I am so excited by the opportunity to work towards that and to work with you all to make sure that our schools are at the forefront of inclusion, that they are well-resourced and doing great things.
So there's one important topic, I guess, that we didn't have an opportunity to chat about tonight, which is our perspective on charter schools. The district has not approved very many charter schools in its history. We have a couple. And last month, the district approved a new charter school for the district. It's an existing private school right outside of Maple Bluff. It pulls from Emerson, Mendota, Lakeview, Gompers, and a couple of other attendance areas. I have somewhat strongly advocated against this school. It's going to cost the district more. The district actually recommended against approving it as well. The school doesn't meet our standards. It doesn't meet our academic standards. The budget doesn't balance. And the demographic of the school is primarily white students right now. For those reasons, the superintendent recommended against it. The board went ahead and approved it, contingent upon changing elements of the proposal. I bring it up because it's a difference of opinion in some of the candidates up here, which is important to know about, but also because I think the way that our district has thought about charters historically has just not been that strategic. And one of the things that I'd like to bring to the table, we're actually hiring someone to the tune of $100,000 to lead charters for the district. So I think this conversation is going to keep coming up over the next several years. And it's important for you to understand how everybody up here thinks about bringing new schools into the district. The more schools we start, the more money we put into buildings and the less money we put into kids. So I am not opposed to public charters. I have a very high threshold for public charters. To me, they need to be in the right geography. They need to be providing something for our neediest students, for our demographics, for our cohorts that we are failing right now. We have those. We also have geographies we're failing. We should be focusing our resources in those needy places and continue to have a very high standard for our academics and other standards. So,
I'd like to thank the Eastside Progressives for hosting this tonight. Very simply, we've heard a lot of public education, but we haven't focused on the fact that public education is going through a lot right now, and it is under attack. Education isn't a choice or a privilege, it's a right. I know what that right is like, and I'm willing to fight for it. I wasn't supposed to be educated. I was supposed to be in a special school for the severely disabled starting at the age of 6. I've been told that educating me was a waste of time. I've had a guidance counselor tell me if I were to survive a college at all, it would have to be in a small women's college that would meet my needs, and even then they couldn't guarantee it. I've been told all that. No student should. I want to focus on how we improve our students' ability to learn. I want them to make them successful, and that's why I'm running for this board. And we can do that by reducing suspensions and expulsions in our school, improving our behavior education plan, asking the tough questions on why so many students leave the district. We can do that by separate exit interview, and most importantly, providing the skills and job readiness our students need. And I ask you for your support on April 4th.
Thank you very much for coming, and thank you all for coming. It's been a wonderful meeting.
Thank you.